Hey there, listeners. Galen here. Before we begin, I just wanted to let you know that we had a bit of audio trouble during our live show in Detroit, but we had a lot of fun and still wanted to share it with you. So hopefully you can bear with us. Here it is. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Grook, and we are coming to you live from the Majestic Theater in downtown Detroit, Michigan. We are just up the street from where the candidates vying for the 2020 Democratic nomination have been debating for the past two nights. And so tonight we're going to discuss the main takeaways from those debates and what they tell us about the Democratic primary going forward. We're also going to have a 2020 Democratic primary draft. You're in luck. We're going to pick teams of candidates based on how likely we think each candidate is to win the Democratic nomination. And then, of course, we're also going to talk about Michigan politics. How could we not? And then we're also going to try to predict whether or not the Democratic nominee in 2020 will campaign in Michigan. Who knows? We'll find out. And here with me to do all of that is this lovely panel next to me, Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
Wildly pandering to the crowd.
I'm from Michigan, Claire. Pander.
This is something of a coming home for Nate. Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone.
Hey, Galen.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. And also, of course, here with us, the most important part of the show is this live audience. Give yourselves a round of applause. All right, so let's begin tonight with the reason we are in Detroit, the debates. Claire, what was your main takeaway from the two nights of debate?
Well, I think everyone's kind of done the whole, the first night was the moderates versus the progressives, right? So it was Team Warren and Bernie versus, I guess, John Delaney, which, good for him. And last night I actually thought was interesting because Joe Biden was much more alive to the conversation than he had been in the first debate. So he was obviously more prepped, I think, for the debate, maybe more comfortable with being aggressive during the debate. And I think the second thing was that Kamala Harris was getting a lot of attacks, and I think that sort of seals the deal for her as far as being a front runner or a top tier candidate.
So it's more of a she's arrived kind of thing than, uh-oh, she's under attack, this isn't looking good for her.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Well, are the polls telling us anything at this point? I know we're only, 24 hours out from the second debate. Do we know anything? Is there anything in the data to tell us so far?
Not really. I mean, there was a Harris X poll that I think is conducted mostly post-debate that show maybe Bernie gaining a couple of points, but it was a small sample and, not the absolute cream of the crop polling-wise, so we're going to have to wait a couple more days. So, we're in that zone where it's mostly people like us making educated or not so educated guesses about how things went down.
And it's interesting because, the debate was on CNN, right? And we had an ongoing live blog chat where we kind of said sort of what I just said, right, which is, Biden seemed better tonight, and Harris was a new frontrunner status. And it was so weird to hear CNN immediately sort of say Biden was terrible, right? This was kind of like a...
Well, I mean, there was a variety of mix. I don't know if more people were watching CNN because they televised the debate. Obviously,
sure.
Yeah. You know, with Biden, it's kind of weird. On the one hand, I think he benefited a lot from lower expectations. You know, he's someone who I think objectively... Well, it's not objective, right? But did not have a great first debate. And that lowered the bar a lot. And for him to be, especially in the first half of the debate, kind of competent plus, I did not think he was great. Actually, one thing when I woke up this morning and kind of rethought the debate, I'm like, oh, Biden was kind of like a B, B minus, C plus. He was not, in my view, again, very subjective.
But you're grading on a curve based on his last debate performance, right?
Well, the B minus, C plus is not in the curve, right? That's like a non-curve grade. On the other hand, Biden, I think, has been pretty chronically underrated by at least big segments of the media kind of throughout the primary process. And somehow in the week or two before the debate, he went from being at 28% in the polls back up to 31 or 32%. Harris went from being at 14% back down to 10 or 11%. Those are fairly significant shifts. You know, meanwhile, Warren and Sanders, especially Warren, have held their numbers in the polls a little bit better. She's kind of had a slow increase where every 3 weeks she gains a point or something. It's not very spectacular at any one moment in time. But, you know, you could say that Warren was a winner of the debates in the sense that I think she comported herself pretty well, that Harris, I think, had an off night, kind of a weirdly off night, where she seemed very subdued at first and her strategy wasn't clear. But, you know, Warren and Bernie certainly present a clear, more clear-cut alternative to Biden. I think that became kind of clear in all this kind of moderate versus liberal framing that, like, and again, maybe when you get, like, more candidates, or rather fewer candidates on stage, there's more room for subtlety and more room for Harris or Buttigieg striking a middle ground.
Harris's proposition is a little bit coalition building, right? She's not Warren, and she's not Warren where she's charting the whole hog progressive path. She's not Biden or Delaney, where she's saying, I'm a moderate. She's trying to marry that stuff. And I also think that she was quiet at certain sections of the debate because she knew she was going to hear stuff about her prosecutorial record, and she wanted to keep quiet about that. I'll also mention that the busing thing from the first debate kind of got a little bit muddled for her after the fact, right? So she kind of had to say, well, yeah, I would have to take the stance of saying that I'm against federally mandated busing, but she said, hypothetically, back a few decades, I would have done a different thing than Joe Biden. So it was kind of like a weird answer that I don't think she wanted to get into.
I want to dig into specific moments in the debate a little bit more. But before we do that, just to kind of set the stakes here, Micah, after the first round of debates, there was a pretty clear relationship between the takeaway and the polling changes, right? Harris did pretty well. She gained about 6 points in the polls on average. Biden did pretty poorly. He lost about 6 points in the polls on average. Is that normal? Are those the kinds of stakes we should expect coming out of the debates of this week?
I think they're less likely to happen the further along we get, just because the voters will be obviously more familiar with the candidates and there's less room for kind of first impressions and that first kind of initial rush of like, oh, I like this person, I'm gonna jump on board. But also I think part of it comes down to the nature of the debate. The first debate lent itself much more to a clean narrative coming out. This debate, actually, I thought both of them were super interesting, but for like political science, long-term party trend reasons, and not so much for like who's gonna win the nomination.
Wait, get into that. What do you mean by that?
I mean, there's just like a big debate going on in the Democratic Party about what the party should stand for.
And I think the first part of both debates, the healthcare portion, was probably the cleanest example
totally,
of that.
Totally, right. And it's like this perfect, perfect issue, and you have like the perfect players on both sides of the debate to very cleanly illustrate this very substantive and very important argument within the party about where they should be on healthcare. Do I think there's going to be like a Delaney surge in the polls coming out of the debate because of it? No.
But Delaney, right? But Delaney is kind of arguing more of the Biden side of things, right? And it's kind of for the benefit of this Michigan audience, right?
It's using for you,
using you as a proxy, right? Which is that yes, a lot of the debate was about the technicalities of healthcare coverage, but a lot of it is the elephant in the room is the general election and winning back blue wall states, right? Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, probably not Ohio anymore. But the idea that it was about healthcare, yes, but it's about an electability strategy, too.
So Claire clearly thinks there's going to be a Delaney surge.
Yes.
That's on tape now.
And as Nate said, we don't really have polling at this point to give us an indication of who's up or down after the debate. But we do have some data that our colleagues at 538 collected. It's on the screen behind us, maybe a little bit hard to see if you're further in the back, but it's essentially who spoke the most, who talked the most about Trump. We see that Joe Biden talked the most of anybody both nights. Second was Kamala Harris, third Elizabeth Warren, fourth Pete Buttigieg. And then who talked the most about Trump? The order was Elizabeth Warren, Steve Bullock, Michael Bennett, then Cory Booker. Is there some kind of relationship between how much you talk and your performance, for better or for worse?
talking more is definitely good. As a recurring guest on this podcast, I think, you know.
You gotta fight to get a word in edgewise.
Yeah, you really gotta.
If you talk faster, though, by this metric, right? It's not speaking time.
Sorry, Nate, words. I wasn't done, actually.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. With so many candidates, they clearly, I think, are conscious of the fact that they have to get in there or risk missing an opportunity. I think some people did miss an opportunity. You look at the people at the bottom of this list, it's some of the same people who were at the bottom for the first debate, and the next debate, we're probably going to have half as many candidates. And so I think some people just lost their moment. This is like a hot take that my colleagues have heard me give before, but I think these debates have like not struck the right balance between inclusiveness and winnowing, right? The whole primary should serve, one of our writers, Julia Zarias, wrote about this, but it's supposed to, one, present voters with options, and then two, winnow those options down so you can pick a nominee. And I think like they're stuck in this uncanny valley where they said, okay, we want to give everybody all the options, but not all the options are equal, so we're going to give way more time to the polling leaders, which is sort of like, well, why even have...
Minus, you know, John Delaney.
Right.
Yeah, well, Delaney got himself in there. But, like, you know, Yang barely got a word in edgewise. Marianne Williamson barely got a word in edgewise. But I know some people. You're pro, get only talk to the Biden, right?
I would be pro having a JV and a varsity debate. I think it's kind of crazy that you haven't had Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden on the same stage yet, for example.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not even sure it hurts. Like, if you're like Gillibrand, where you could kind of dominate maybe the JV debate, then I'm not sure that's worse than being the candidate who's going to get like the seventh most airtime and kind of be, no matter how well you do, an afterthought. Because we saw in the first round of debates, we saw Castro, for example, have a good night and maybe gain half a point in the polls. You know, Booker this time, I thought, had a good night last night. Maybe he will gain more. He's a little bit more viable than Castro. But what if he goes from 2.4 to 3.1, right? That doesn't necessarily make a huge difference. And so I wouldn't mind kind of doing what they did 4 years ago.
I think looking back on this primary process, there will be plenty of critiques to make at the end of the process, as people did with the 2016 process for Republicans. And we will see for Democrats if it goes more smoothly. Before we move on to some of the specific topics discussed in the debate, we've got a couple more data points, which is basically, you know, we saw how much talking the candidates did. This is what the public saw, or first inkling of what the public thought in terms of Twitter followers, who got more Twitter followers after the two nights of debate. The top four are Gabbard, Williamson, Yang, and Buttigieg.
So it's just like the weirdos.
I mean, maybe everyone was already following Biden and Warren and Booker. I don't know. And then, of course, you also saw that the second night of debate had more viewers, although overall, both nights of debate this week had 40% fewer viewers than the first debate. Anyway, with that as a backdrop, we talked about healthcare. Were there any other flashpoints, Claire, that you thought were indicative of divisions within the party that we saw this week?
Well, I guess the other big topic is immigration, and the new litmus test for Democrats, I guess, has become whether or not you should criminalize border crossings. And it sort of turned into, I think, a slightly unhelpful debate about should we make it a civil offense rather than a criminal offense to cross the border. And there was a lot of kind of equivocating and maybe sort of saying your stance in a forgettable way and then saying, well, it's terrible to put children in cages, right? There wasn't a really nuanced systemic debate on immigration, but it was a point where a lot of people went after each other. You know, Booker was quite forceful in saying, listen, you were part of Obama's deportation policy. You can't own parts of Obama's record when you're talking about race and then disown Obama when you're talking about immigration policy. So I thought that was interesting, and it kind of speaks to the people are trying to frame it as a moral question. A lot of this primary so far has been about recent history. Well, not quite recent history.
About Trump?
It's been about how people framed their stances within the Democratic Party. Before, the Democratic Party was filled with a lot of people who identify as Democratic Socialists. I mean, 2016 was the first year that Democrats said, I think this is in a Gallup survey, that they identify socialism as a better thing than capitalism. And that is a really striking point. And a lot of the things that they were debating last night and sort of pillaring Biden for kind of used to be standard fare in the Democratic Party.
No, and you saw that with immigration, where how much in either debate did you see anybody talking about border security? Democrats used to not be able to talk about immigration at all without being able to, without saying first, of course we have to lock down the border and make it super secure, but here's what I actually want to do. Now that they don't feel compelled to do that, which I think speaks to how far they moved.
And you saw Bennett saying, well, I was part of the Gang of Eight,
right?
Like, I was part of attempts at comprehensive immigration reform. That's so 10 years ago. I think Gillibrand started to get into an interesting substantive thing, which is when people present for asylum, sexual assault is not typically a thing that you can claim asylum for. Now, quite a lot of the women coming from Central America are fleeing domestic abuse. There are real things to debate on this. There's real foreign policy debate when it comes to how should the American government handle what's going on in Central America. But I think that it's safer for Democrats to kind of poke at each other, at least for right now, on decriminalization. Because understandably, the immediate thing that we're all seeing is really striking images at the border.
Let me throw out one other moment that stood out to me, which was when Warren, I actually forget who she was. I think she was responding to Delaney. She was like, why even bother running for president if you're not going to...
If you're just going to tell us what we can't do.
So, unlike the first debate, they actually had explicit prompts
about
electability, which I kind of like because voters actually care about that. And how do you beat Trump is a very big concern to a lot of voters. I think she kind of has one of the harder cases to make for electability. She's from a very blue state. She hasn't actually won by that huge margins. Maybe that matters, maybe it doesn't. But yeah, I mean, she made, I think, the best argument that she could make. And I know it's an important argument. She has to overcome a lot of doubts about, like, can you beat Trump? And I think she did a good job with that.
So. But see, and I think that's the way for Warren and for Bernie and most of the people on the more progressive side, they are much stronger in that kind of left versus center argument when they're making it about kind of boldness and idealism and not being timid, right? As opposed to a lot of the debate played out along, like, how much does your plan cost? And what exactly would it mean for people with this type of insurance? And on those issues, I think, frankly, like Warren and Bernie do get into a little trouble because their plans are
expensive.
Really, really expensive and really disruptive.
And also unpopular. We talked about this on the podcast earlier this week on Monday. When you talk about abolishing private insurance, you get underwater pretty fast with the American public. By the way, I will say, I know we're in Motor City, but I didn't know that they were going to be playing a motor during our live podcast. But it creates a nice ambiance.
It's like a
appreciated.
Yeah.
No, but anyway, motor aside, I do think that level of disruption to the system does seem to be unpopular. But I think the way out of it for the Warrens of the world is to make it about vaguer concepts of being bold and less about the actual plans. I don't know if that'll work, but it at least sounds better on a debate stage.
When Nate and I spoke on Tuesday night after the first debate, one of our takeaways was that kind of moderation was pushing back against the progressivism that we've seen for the past, I don't know, something like 2 years plus in the Democratic Party. And the hot take was, hey, okay, even if Delaney doesn't benefit from this, maybe he does a lot of Biden's work for him or something like that, so long as Biden doesn't really, like, mess it up in the second night of debate. Claire and Micah, is there anything to that? I mean, do you think that moderation is making somewhat of a comeback within the Democratic Party after being in the background for the past 2.5 years? Or is that just too hot of a take and BS?
It's a take through a lens, right? The people who have been paying attention to the election so far are probably, not to stereotype people in this room, but people in this room, right? People, probably people from urban areas, people who are college educated, people in the media. And I do think that there is, listen, culturally, socially, things like democratic socialism are more popular in younger circles, they're more popular in urban areas largely. And so I think, and it's also, we talk about this a lot, it's an exciting media narrative. And it is a real shift that's happening in the party. Like, the numbers don't lie. But also, lots of older people vote, right? That's who vote, like, that is a really solid demographic. And also, let's talk about people in, I think black voters are the biggest constituency where you see electability and moderation sort of being a valued quality, that's a huge part of the Democratic electorate. So moderation never went away. It's just that more people are tuning in. I had someone tell me, listen, these candidates need to prove that they're viable by mid-September, otherwise they're dead on arrival. I mean, we're basically, you know, February is not that far away. That's when the first votes are cast, and people are starting to tune in. So I think it's just that moderation is, it's there. It's also, we're talking about, like, Kamala Harris didn't release her healthcare plan until this week. And it's not Medicare for All. It's not the Senate bill that she signed on to in 2017. So you are seeing people make active concessions to, hey, people don't love the idea of their private insurance being taken away. What should I do to make a compromise on this?
We should move on and talk about Michigan politics, since we are in Michigan. But before we do that, let's wrap up on this. At the beginning, Nate had the opportunity to say that I think you mentioned you thought Elizabeth Warren might have been the winner of the two nights of debate. I want to get Micah and Claire to weigh in on that question before we move on.
Oh, I don't know. No, I'm serious. It's like, what do we mean?
I'm not going to get a hot take out of you?
No, like, what do you mean by win? Like, who's the best messenger?
Well, I mean, I think, okay, I would say who most increased their chance of winning the nomination? I think you can probably say either Warren or Biden.
Yeah.
Even though I don't think Biden
but
was
you
like...
Also, but you also see people like, I think Booker is actually been pretty good in these debates. So there's also the idea of if you're a candidate who needs to say, like, man, I need to get in the top six.
But if, like, Bullock has a good debate and his chances go from 0.1% to 0.5% of winning the nomination, he increased them by 500%, right? But, like, it's still 0.5%. Whereas of the major candidates, I thought Harris was weirdly mediocre, and I think Biden benefited from other people being flat.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
And Warren, I think, was good.
Warren was very proficient. She's also doing well in the polls. Like Nate, she's a former high school debater.
Oh, yeah.
So.
I think Warren performed really well. I think Booker performed really well. I thought Bullock did really well.
Did John Delaney do well?
I thought Delaney did well.
Tulsi Gabbard did pretty well.
I thought Gabbard. Actually, I thought Marion Williamson had a couple good moments.
Everyone wins.
Wait, on Money and Politics, in Race, she basically won that section of the debate.
All right, so Williamson surge, Delaney surge. The one thing I would say is, One of the previous charts, it showed Bullock mentioned Trump among the most of any of the candidates. And I actually think that could be an interesting strategy for one of the more moderate candidates, is to just go all after Trump and use that to kind of get attention. So I don't know. I think he could come out of it maybe with a little more steam than he had going in. But Nate's right that, like, he's at such a low baseline. And then Biden, look, the easy thing to say is, like, oh, Biden was the winner of the debate because no one else stood out and Harris had a flat night. But if that's Biden having a good night, then I think Biden is in trouble.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk about Michigan politics. Michigan is a state, perhaps alongside Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, that's occupied a certain place in the psyche of the Democratic Party over the past few years. It's also a state that President Trump seems pretty fond of. He has already campaigned here this year. He was in Grand Rapids in March. And actually, for this part of our conversation tonight, we have a special guest joining us. So, Robert Yoon, come on out and join us on stage. And let me tell you who Robert is. Of course, you don't know who you're applauding for necessarily yet. Robert Yoon is a visiting professor at the University of Michigan. He's also a reporter and analyst. Oh, yeah. Hey. He's also a reporter and analyst at Inside Elections, and he is the former director of political research at CNN. So thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Great
I really appreciate
to be here.
It.
Thank you for having me.
And before we move on to Michigan, I do want to ask you one question. You were actually in the debate hall the past two nights. I was stuck in the press room, which is, like, just crowded and smells bad. How was the actual debate hall?
Well, the Fox Theater is a beautiful venue, so it was a great place to hold an event.
Detroit proud, yeah.
Right. For me, it was a little weird because this was actually the first CNN debate since 1999 that I wasn't helping to plan. And so sitting in the audience is a completely different experience than watching from the control room and not having had input into the question writing process. And the experience of watching it inside the hall is different than on TV because you see kind of the larger dynamics going on. It's sort of like the difference between watching a stage production on Broadway or watching the movie version of that same story.
Right, like the face that Gillibrand is making when Biden is talking or something like that that the public doesn't get to see.
Right, and you see a lot of the sometimes small interactions between the candidates or sometimes between the candidates and the moderator. I think you did see some of this on TV, but they're constantly trying to get the attention of the moderators. But and it looks like everyone is either trying to, they're at an auction where they're like bidding on something or trying to hail taxis. So they're constantly trying to get the attention of the moderator. So there's a lot going on in the wings and in as we saw last night in the audience also.
In fact, what was the Twitter line after the first night of debate that the debate looked like West Wing f***ed an auction or something like that? Anyway, let's talk about Michigan. And we'll start with kind of this broad question that doesn't have a lot of nuance to it maybe, and we'll try to give it some nuance. How would you categorize Michigan as a state? Is it purple? Is it red? Is it blue? I mean, I know it hadn't voted for a Republican since 1988, so Democrats seemingly had forgotten about it as a state that they had to fight for. Does that mean it was a blue state? Is it now a red state? What say you?
Right. Well, it's definitely a question that's gotten asked a lot since the 2016 election, and there are a few different ways to answer it or to look at it. The most basic one is, you know, if you were to color a map of Michigan and color in the counties that each candidate won, it's hard to say that it's, Michigan is not a red state. Trump won 75 counties, I think. Clinton won 8. Although a lot of states look like that, where the less populated counties tend to go for the Republican, the more populous counties vote for the Democrat, and that's not reflected in that type of thing. But it's definitely red now. It looks red if you look at it on a map. But if you look at, you know, another basic metric, it was the closest margin of any state in 2016. And on top of that, it wasn't just the closest state in 2016, it was the closest presidential election in Michigan's history. And the only thing that even came close was from the early 1900s. So in that respect, it's probably the purplest state in the country.
Only 10,000 votes, I'm sure.
Right.
Y'all know that.
And the other thing is that even though Michigan has voted consistently for the Democratic presidential candidate since 1988 up until 2016, even though that was happening and it made it look like a blue state and, you know, it helped earn its identity as a blue state, there was a lot of purple undercurrents, you know, happening below the surface. It's not a state that Democrats had locked up from head to toe. You know, the governorship routinely changed hands between parties up until maybe about a decade ago. The Senate seats would change hands. So in that respect, even while it was a blue state, there were a lot of strong areas for Republicans.
What can we say about why the state voted for Donald Trump in 2016?
First of all, we tend to think of this as like a one-dimensional problem between like red and blue. Michigan also has a fairly long history of being a change state or an anti-incumbent state. It was a key state for Ronald Reagan in 1980. It was a big state. I remember Bill Clinton came to East Lansing, I think, in 1992.
When Nate was just a young child. No, I'm kidding. You were older.
Not that young. I was 14, right? But yeah, you know, it's always been a swing state. But Jesse Jackson won the 1988 Democratic caucus in a pivotal state that prolonged his campaign in 88. Bernie Sanders won in 2016 in a big upset versus the polls.
The biggest upset of the Democratic primary in 2016.
One of the biggest upsets relative to the polls in polling history. Although demographically, it's not that surprising that Bernie won, given that Michigan has this history of like kind of picking upsets and picking anti-establishment candidates. And so I think Trump like fit into that. At the same time, he won by 0.2 or whatever percent, so we shouldn't overdraw that lesson too much. I mean, the question is more like going forward, which way are the trends pointing? And like, if you look at that map, it's like a little bit contradictory in some ways.
And just for the listeners at home, the map that Nate is talking about is Michigan votes by county in 2016 in the presidential election versus Michigan votes by county in the 2018 gubernatorial election, which Gretchen Whitmer won by almost a 10-point margin.
So I want to ask you two, this side of the room, the elections analyst experts. So we talk a lot about... I'm just some schmell up here. We talk a lot about states that move together, right? So Michigan and Ohio.
Oh, my God, Ohio.
But this is pertinent. This is pertinent, right?
Oh, boo.
Whatever.
That was a boo line.
Muck Michigan. Okay. But why? So you're talking about Michigan has an independent street. It bucks the trend. People have sort of largely assumed to have written off Ohio as a swing state, right? They're saying, oh, it's going to be in the red column.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? Like, why are these two states that we've tied together for so long perhaps drifting apart?
First of all, I think Detroit Metro is larger by a fair margin than any metro area in Ohio, so that's important. And Detroit's changing a lot, of course. You know, it has places like Grand Rapids, which are pretty well educated. It has places like Lansing, East Lansing, which are pretty well educated. Northern Michigan used to have a little bit of like the Northern Minnesota tradition of being like kind of blue-collar Democrat.
Right.
And a lot of that is a place where Trump has done much better.
So
but there's still like a little bit of it relative to, you know, I mean, there's also questions about like the auto bailout and how that played. I mean, one reason why Obama did so well, I think, here in 2012 was because of the auto bailout, because of Mitt Romney writing an editorial that had the headline, "Let Detroit Go Bankrupt," and whatever else.
So we're talking about the idea that, okay, Democrats can write off rural areas, but urban and suburban areas are more, they're better for Democrats. There are literally more mid-sized cities that could have urban areas or suburbs, and therefore there's more opportunity in Michigan for Democrats?
I mean, it's fairly, so there's no part of Michigan that is southern, where there are parts of Ohio that are, effectively. There is a strong labor union movement in Michigan, which I think helps Democrats to some degree here. You have, Ohio has good universities, as is Wisconsin, but you have two major research universities here, and that makes Ann Arbor and East Lansing quite blue. So, I don't know, I mean, it just kind of is one of those states where you kind of go through the math, and, like, it seems fairly even. It's also a state where you have, like, a fair amount in some counties of, like, population loss. Mm-hmm. So while, on the one hand, like, kind of northeastern Michigan, the Thumb, those regions are, like, becoming much more Republican, they're also losing people, and so that isn't as unequivocally good for Republicans as it might be in some other state.
Robert, I'm curious what your take is on some of the demographic and geographic trends in Michigan and what they tell us about its political future.
I want to suck up to the crowd a little bit and say Cleveland is no Detroit. And I think...
Shots fired!
No, but... the hugest bastion of Democratic votes comes from this area and areas that Nate mentioned as well. When that starts to waver, when something happens to that base, then we see what we saw in 2016. But in terms of demographic changes, there are I guess the main thing that people have talked about with regard to Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin since 2016, the level of non-college educated voters in those states, a lot of the statewide polls ended up having difficulty kind of capturing that factor in their polling. But if you look at the counties in Michigan and, you know, rank them by the numbers with the most non-college educated voters, the top 40 of those counties, Obama in 2008 won about half of those counties. And then in 2016, Hillary Clinton won zero of those counties. So that's one indicator of how that demographic seems to have shifted in Michigan over that time. In the two Obama elections, it didn't seem to matter enough to sway the election either way, but when there are all these other factors going on, that applies to other demographics as well in terms of when you look at things that might traditionally you would think help Democrats in terms of counties with a high percentage of people without health insurance, or with high poverty rates, or even one metric I think is interesting. When you look at counties with the lowest percentage of broadband internet, which often is a proxy for determining whether something's a rural area or not, the top 30 counties for no broadband internet, or for the least amount of broadband internet, again, President Obama won about half of those in 2008, and Hillary Clinton won zero. So I think that's reflective of the larger trend where these rural, less college educated are shifting.
And kind of getting into the topic of broadband, it seems like it gets at a deep cultural divide that we often talk about in terms of the white working class, et cetera, but access and all of these kinds of questions come into play here, and probably different parts of Michigan are just living in entirely different cultures. We do, though, as members of the press, we get a lot of pushback when we focus on the white working class only in talking about Trump's success in the upper Midwest. And I know that Trump won Michigan in 2016 while winning fewer votes than George W. Bush did in 2004 when he lost Michigan. So what are the other dynamics at play here apart from the white working class vote in Michigan?
Black turnout is a big one.
Which was down, yeah.
Clinton, I think, compared to Obama, lost like
77,000 in Michigan.
Yeah, tens and tens of thousands of votes, actually in this area alone. And that really hurt her margin. To me, the big question is like, how much of that is a natural letdown after having the first black president in U.S. history? And how much of that was about just that kind of unique moment in 2016? To put that another way, what will black turnout look like in 2020? If it is depressed like it was in 2016, at least relative to 2012, then I think Democrats could have problems in Michigan again. Again, depending on what the national environment is like. But if, depending on who the nominee is, they can turn out the Democratic base in a similar way that Obama did, they should be able to do better here. The thing, though, is like Michigan, I think this is the official 538 position, at least we're on record as saying this, but I think Michigan was always a swing state. Even when Democrats were winning it year after year after year in presidential election, they weren't winning it by a ton.
Well, Obama won it. I mean, there were a lot of factors that happened to make it an especially good Obama state, right? Number one, you are going to have historically high levels of black turnout for the first African-American president, or you would think at least. Number two, it was a state that in 2008 suffered a lot from the recession and then benefited in 2012 a lot from the recovery. And number three, Obama is from the Midwest, and I believe that there is something about regions, and there's just an intangible where you communicate a little bit more effectively. Those three things were all not present for Clinton, and it's a change state. So that really helped. I mean, Obama won by a big margin here in 2008. It was well into the double digits, I think.
You're also seeing 17 stuff, points about, yeah.
You're also seeing stuff from 2018 where there are certain demographic groups that are moving, right? Non-college-educated white women were moving a little more into the Democrats' column. So I think that does, in a state like Michigan, that can make a difference, right? We talked a lot during the midterms about college-educated white women trending much more Democratic. I think it's interesting to see, you know, non-college-educated white women, perhaps with the right kind of candidate. I think people would say, oh, Biden. Right. Maybe they'll move into the Democrats column.
And look, at the end of the day, Michigan is 75% white. So Democrats aren't going to win in Michigan. And of course, the majority of white people in Michigan are not college educated. So Democrats are not going to win in Michigan if they can't make up some ground with the, you know, demographic groups that you were talking about, Robert.
No, and you saw some of that, as Claire just mentioned, in 2018, where some of those non-college white groups reverted back to Democrats. But I guess the question is, so in 2016, Michigan was more Republican leaning than the country overall, barely by 2 points or 2.5 points, something like that. But by that measure, it's a sort of very, very slightly light red state. And I'll be really interested in 2020 to see, again, depending on some of this, depending on black turnout, depending on how much do non-college women go back to Democrats, how much do non-college men keep going to Republicans? Where is Michigan relative to the country? I think it's a pretty safe bet that it'll be close to the tipping point.
I think, look, if you think that the Democrat is 50-50 to win the Electoral College, I think they're above 50% to win Michigan. I think it's a little bit easier for the Democrat than Wisconsin, for
and
instance,
let's actually,
or Florida.
We have Trump's approval rating in Michigan up on the screen behind us. So It's gone up and down a little bit, but in general, Trump's net approval in Michigan has hovered around negative 10 points. So what does that foretell?
Well, first of all, let's remember the polls were off in Michigan in 2016, and they were really far off in the Democratic primary. So, you know,
so we shouldn't necessarily trust this?
You have to be a little bit careful. But I don't know. I mean, look, I think it sort of happens that, like, most of the more plausible Democratic nominees are the kind of candidate Michigan would get behind. I mean, Bernie did well here. There is, like, a little bit of progressive tradition. Kamala Harris is African-American. Joe Biden has the working class thing, right? So I think any of them are kind of, like, better Michigan candidates than Clinton was. He didn't quite have any of those attributes. But, look, I mean, it is technically – Wisconsin was a tipping point state. So Michigan was actually slightly by half a point to the left of the tipping point. I think Wisconsin, which is whiter than Michigan
– Explain what you mean by tipping point.
Tipping point means a state that if you line the states up in order of most Republican and most Democratic, that's where the 270th decisive electoral vote comes. But Wisconsin is whiter than Michigan. It's a state where the GOP has had more persistent success in statewide elections. So Wisconsin would worry me more if I were a Democrat than Michigan. Not that Michigan would be easy, but you know, I think Pennsylvania and Michigan are slightly easier gets for the Democrat than Wisconsin. But you need all three to actually get to the tipping point.
All right, well, I think we're going to wrap up this conversation. But Robert, before we let you go, what is your thinking right now in terms of how we should assess Trump's chances in 2020 in Michigan, given the trends that we're talking about and the data you have?
Will sure. Trump win Michigan?
Well, the answer is, well, right. So everyone wants to know whether what happened in 2016 was a fluke, whether it's the tip of a spear, a Republican spear, the start of a long trend, the end of one trend and the beginning of another one in favor of Republicans. And, you know, we were talking about Ohio a minute ago. You know, Ohio has been, you know, the quintessential swing state for cycle after cycle. But the last few cycles, it's been getting more and more Republican. So whether that's happening to Michigan or not, you know, I'd love to answer your question in 8 to 16 years. So I can say it more definitively. There were 12 counties that flipped from blue to red from between 2012 and 2016. I know you have an audience listening at home and visual aids aren't helpful, but about half of them are in the lower right quadrant of Michigan, kind of at the base of the thumb. And Democrats have shown, across, you know, up and down the ballot that they can do well here and that what happened in 2016 isn't necessarily a sign of things to come. You know, Gretchen Whitmer won about half of the counties that Hillary Clinton lost of those 12 that flipped. And then something Nate mentioned, demographically, most of the counties in Michigan are losing population. And if you look at all the states that lost population from 2010 to now, Donald Trump won those states by and large. And then if you look at the top states that gained population, Democrats are winning those. And I know it's a bigger picture than that, but it doesn't help you to win close elections when your constituency is shrinking. I mean, that's kind of a longer term thing for Republicans to keep an eye on. But yeah, it I think it is a sign that it's not necessarily the start of a new Republican era in Michigan, that it'll remain competitive for a while to come.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Robert. Give him a round of applause. All right, and now we get to have some fun. It is time for our 2020 Democratic primary draft. So there we go. Get another beer. All right, so there are about 25 Democrats vying for the party's nomination, depending on how you count. We just saw 20 of them make their pitch to the American people just down the street from here. So we're going to draft teams of candidates we think are most likely to win the nomination in 2020. We haven't done this since they started debating, so this should be fun. You guys are in luck. And just to clarify, we're drafting candidates based on how likely we think they are to win the nomination, not to win the presidency. So key distinction there. The last two times we did this, Nate and Claire started. So we are going to begin with Micah, and this is a snake draft, right? So whoever goes last gets to pick two people, and then we'll go back around. Micah. You're up first.
I pick Joe Biden.
Mixed reviews.
Safe pick.
Safe pick. No, he's the polling leader. I'm like, relative to other people, I think pretty bearish on Biden's chances. I just don't think he's looked that great on the campaign trail. But he's, you know, winning. And that counts for something. So I'll pick Joe Biden.
I mean, he's kind of winning by a lot. Like, I feel like people are not weighing the significance enough of Biden had, I think, a fairly crappy first debate and then recovered almost all that he had lost in the polling. I mean, that is really scary if you're... I think that should affect your priors quite a bit. That if that can't affect him, then I can still imagine many ways in which he would lose. But more of the ways that he would lose to me involve another candidate managing to get up to 25% or 30% and equaling him, or maybe surpassing him in Iowa and New Hampshire, where his polling is not all that strong, as opposed to Biden just spontaneously disappearing.
Oh, I'm stuck between two. Don't tell me what to do. But also, yeah, I think I'm going to pick Harris. And I'm going to do Harris because Harris is, we've talked about this quite a bit on the podcast, I think, and I talked about it a little bit in the first debate segment. She is positioning herself as a pragmatist coalition builder, right? And I think that that is, it has the chance to go really far in a super fragmented primary. She can be your woman candidate. She can be your candidate of color. She can be your kind of progressive candidate, but also the person who's like trying to make things work candidate. She's an executive candidate. All these things where she might provide some appeal to people. She also risks being...
all things to all people and, yeah. / no things to no people.
Right, exactly.
That's the thing.
That's the thing.
So I think Harris is sort of an interesting pick. And she's also, you know, I think she's... you see her in person, and she can be quite at once forceful and warm on the stuff. I think that's interesting. I think she's had some trouble articulating clearly what her policy stances are in the town halls, in the debate. The first debate, she had trouble with policy stuff. I think that's probably a little bit of a problem and something that her campaign is really working on, but she's an interesting candidate, and so I'm going to go with that kind of safe coalition building answer.
I mean, she is like a... when we have to have a sports metaphor or three, right? She's like a pitcher who has like five different pitches that she throws and not always in the right sequences or at the right times, right? She's like, cut it down to like a fastball, a slider, and a changeup, right? You don't need that knuckle curve or whatever.
And sometimes we don't need sports metaphors.
Okay.
she's also super new to national politics. She was only elected to the Senate in 2016.
Yeah.
Like, people really, and, you know, people will say, well, that was the case with Obama, right? But Obama had a little more experience.
We're going to move along, and I'm next. So I am going to pick the person that I think must be the obvious third choice at this point, which is Elizabeth Warren. By the way, somebody shouted yang. I knew this would be a yang gang kind of situation. Anyway, there are various reasons you could pick Elizabeth Warren at this point in the draft, one of which I've made before during past drafts when I've picked Warren, which is that she is the obvious candidate to be able to appeal to the progressive flank of the party while still appealing to the establishment. But I'm actually going to make another argument, which is that I think that the progressive candidates in the race, their odds of becoming the nominee have the potential to increase if things get a little bit rocky with the economy. And I am not a recession forecaster, and there's a very good chance, well, the New York Fed says there's a 2 in 3 chance that there won't be a recession in the next year. However, there's a 1 in 3 chance the Fed just lowered the interest rate for the first time in a decade because of the global economy slowing. If people start to see layoffs or if there is trouble in the economy, I think the people who are more bold, let's redo the system messengers stand to gain in a situation where people are worried about their future economic prospects. Whereas in a situation like this, Joe Biden doesn't have to be talking about how he will change the economy because people have jobs and there's wage growth, et cetera. But if things go south, then I would say that a Sanders or a Warren have a better
shot. What a thoughtful answer.
Claire, why are you so surprised?
No, yeah, I just, like, you talked about interest rates, which we do not do on this podcast.
Hey, I mean, I read the Wall Street Journal.
Why Warren and not Bernie?
For the reason that I started with, which is that she can still appeal to the establishment. Look, like, the party is not just on the debate stage, but in actuality split in two. When you ask Democrats, about 50% of Democrats identify as either moderate or conservative. So you have a better chance of winning the nomination and maybe of winning the election ultimately if you are at least able to appeal to some of those moderates. And it gets tricky because I know that Bernie Sanders actually does appeal to some people who identify as conservative just because of how identity works and because people don't necessarily vote along ideological lines. But I do think if you want somebody who can thrive in an environment where people are unsure about the economy but still get establishment voters, Elizabeth Warren is your person.
I buy that. Yeah. Do you think Bernie would ever endorse Warren?
Yes. He endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
with a gun.
That was his only option.
So my pick?
Yeah. Your pick.
I think Bernie is a pretty clear number four. Look, I don't have... There's... Oh.
Crickets.
Look, there are certainly negative indicators for Bernie, one of which being he does not do as well with highly engaged voters. That's a very bearish indicator for him. Nor as well as you would think he would be doing in Iowa, which was a state that he got 50% of the vote and tied, basically, last time. And also, I think he probably does have more limitations in kind of how large his coalition could become. At some point, though, there's something to be said for, hey, look, we know that polling averages are somewhat predictive, not perfectly so, but somewhat, and everything else is narrative BS that doesn't really hold up that well, right? So with Bernie, you're kind of betting on the fact that, look, he's at 15%, which is not great, but it's higher than anyone except Biden. I guess Warren's also about 15%. And he'll figure it out somehow, right? He has a lot of money. He's a good organization. He's done it before. He's certainly in a big divided field. Is somewhere you know what he stands for. So I like actually like kind of cross paths with conventional wisdom a bit. There was a time when in betting markets, people were like, oh, Bernie is the favorite. I think that never really made any sense. But to me, like Bernie has...
Wait. When we did this like a year or two ago, I feel like you were the one making the case that Bernie Sanders should be considered the front runner.
But that was before other people were in.
Before other people, yeah.
Well, that was before it was cool.
That was like 3 years ago.
3 years ago. Okay, whatever.
And but, you know, but I think in the debates, like, when you're on a field with 15 candidates, or 24 candidates, right, then to have the most clearly enunciated stance of any candidate in the field is helpful, I think. Because we see like a Buttigieg or like a Harris get like a little bit kind of squashed in the middle. And so, you know, I mean, I think the Sanders people have always said they benefit from a divided field. And you probably need a couple of things to go right. You probably need Warren somehow not to catch more fire. One reason that might occur is because she has not yet made a lot of penetration into non-college voters. That's a little bearish for Warren. Of course, Biden is maybe a bigger problem for Bernie. But, you know, the kind of parlay where Warren's appeal doesn't go beyond kind of college-educated, white, wonky voters, and where Biden does flame out because maybe he has too many bad debates or whatever else, and Bernie's in a position to have a good organization in Iowa and New Hampshire, none of that's crazy, right?
All right, you've got a second pick, actually. Who is it?
I think the number five is clear-ish, and I think it's probably Mayor Pete. Like, nothing really has gone wrong for Buttigieg yet. He raised a lot of money. He polls better in Iowa and New Hampshire than he does nationally, and he's from the Midwest, which I think can help in Iowa. He's also, though, in a weird way, parallel to Bernie, where I don't know if a coalition can become broad enough.
He's too, like, he doesn't have much of appeal to African-American voters.
Yeah, doesn't have a lot of appeal to, you know, and there's a question of, like, there are certain Democrats who maybe are not ready to elect a gay candidate. There are also gay Democrats. I think like 8 or 9% of the primary electorate is LGBTQ, which can be a strength. But like he doesn't have like a hot spot in the coalition where there's a big, there are a lot, for example, of young leftist voters in the Democratic Party, right? That is a base for Brenna is pretty solid. There are not that many kind of young, sort of moderate whites necessarily, so I don't know. But again, we're talking about the fifth most likely person. I mean, in some ways, I feel like the top of the field is kind of underrated in some ways, right? So I would say that between Biden, Harris, and Warren, I think those three are more than 50% to win the nomination. I'm not even sure it's that close, 50%.
So what's Mayor Pete's cabinet position going to be?
Ambassador of the Netherlands? I don't know. No, I mean, he could run for Congress or something. I mean, I think he obviously has a very bright future, right? But you know, he's another one where, like Castro or something, he had, I think, a pretty good first debate and did not gain in the polls.
It's also worth mentioning, in an environment where Democrats care a lot about electability, that he does not have traditional credentials to be president of the United States. He's currently the mayor of 100,000 people, which is 1/7 of a congressional district. So, he does not have a lot of experience.
And I think that, I think it helps in the debate specifically where you can, like, actually talk and say, hey, look, I was the Attorney General of California. I was the Vice President of the United States.
Back to me. I am going to go with one.
I thought it was back to me.
No, I got two picks.
No, it's a snake draft.
I'm getting confused because we're sitting out of order.
Want to switch?
No.
I am going to go with one Cory Booker.
Good pick.
That is a good pick.
Good pick.
And I think we didn't talk about him that much in the debate segment, but I think he is somebody who came away from this week's debate looking good. I think he's struggled a little bit in the past with being theatrical, but not kind of nailing whatever policies he's necessarily talking about. Anyway, he did pretty well in the debates this week. He, like in a way that you mentioned in referring to Harris, has the ability to put together a coalition that he may not have behind him now, but could have under different circumstances, those circumstances being Biden falling in the polls, those circumstances being performing well in an early state that creates momentum. So he has potential that has not yet been realized in the polls that on average show him at 2%. All right, Claire, it's your call.
It's hard now.
I know, it is hard now. Again,
I had Booker above Buttigieg.
Yeah, me too.
That's arguable, yeah.
Me too. I know who I should pick statistically, which is Beto O'Rourke. But I think I'm going to pick Julian Castro. He obviously had a very surprisingly standout first debate, although I don't know, surprisingly, the man is a well-credentialed former cabinet member. But he's got a space in the party in the sense of he was actually, I think, he took Biden by surprise last night when he went after him on immigration policy. I mean, Biden almost looked like he was slapped. You know, he really didn't expect that because Castro was part of the Obama administration, and I think that there was a little bit of assumed friendliness. I think people have talked a lot about how Castro and Warren are kind of friendly. My sense is about Castro is that he is kind of a wonky person. So he's one of those people who I think was kind of, I'm going to dig in and be a hard worker, and did kind of shine in the debates. So I'd put money on Castro.
All right. I think that's fair.
That's fine.
We're going to start motoring through them. So, Micah, you have two picks, and then we'll go back around.
You guys took my picks. I'm going to go with Amy Klobuchar and Bullock. Wait, can I pick?
Muted applause. Muted applause.
Would you guys applaud more if I picked Inslee's just handsome face?
Wait, clearly the answer is yes. Okay.
You can't do that.
You can't just
I'm focus grouping my pick here. No.
So who'd you pick?
It's what he said. It's Klobuchar and Bullock.
There's not a debate.
No. I'm changing it. I'm going.
It's like a board game. You put your pieces on the board.
I still had my finger on the chess piece. I'm going to pick, I do want to pick Inslee. I'm going to go Klobuchar-Inslee.
Okay, fine.
Micah has talked about Jay Inslee's square jaw.
First, the real reason
he was staying at our hotel in Detroit. He does have a nice jaw.
He's just a handsome guy. So there's that. But no, I thought he's another person who I thought was really good in the debate last night. He has a clear message. If candidates like Inslee or Klobuchar, and I think this applies to Castro a little bit too, if they can somehow find a way to still be in it when the field narrows, then I feel like they'll have a much better chance. Part of that sounds obvious. Of course they would, because the field would be narrowed. But they actually have a compelling message, and they're good at communicating it, as opposed to, I think, there are some candidates who don't have that and who are doing better than them right now. And so if they can just get this kind of sustained oxygen, I think they could do well. So Klobuchar, Inslee.
All right. Claire?
Okay.
It helps if you ask the audience a little bit. And
I think now I had to pick O'Rourke. He hasn't been picked, right?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm picking... Speaking of a man with no country...
Yeah.
If Beto doesn't do well, what's he going to do? So I'm picking O'Rourke.
What's the problem with the O'Rourke campaign?
Buttigieg.
Is it?
Yeah. I think so. I think it's like...
I think it is the man without a country thing, right? He is like no people that kind of are getting his back right now, and there are various reasons for that, right? In some
ways...
He also
peaked during the 2018 midterms and then kind of got on the media list.
And like the worst way to get media coverage is to have a reputation for being a media darling, right? You get shat on by the media if you have a reputation for being a media darling usually, and he gained that early.
Can I make my argument for my guy?
Yeah, okay.
My pick. he could do well in Iowa, right? And I think that's kind of where their campaign is focusing, is that O'Rourke could potentially do well in a retail politics state. He is, if you notice during the campaign or in his press releases, they talk a lot about independent voters, rural places. Like, they are kind of making this argument of, we talk a lot about the happy warriors versus the kind of, like, open, like, fighters against Trump. I think he's trying to place himself in that happy warrior camp. I don't know if it's going to do well, but I think Iowa is probably... I think if O'Rourke doesn't do well in Iowa... And if he hasn't dropped out by then, he'll drop out after Iowa if he doesn't do well.
It's just so hard to run as a more of a moderate candidate without appealing at all to, like, black voters.
Well, but although, okay, here's one thing about Beto is, like, he certainly won in a majority Hispanic district. And, like, if you look at his platform, there's, like, actually a lot of stuff about, like, criminal justice and immigration and issues that, like, appeal maybe to non-white voters more than the other white guys in the race. So there's kind of some material to work with there, but, like...
But it hasn't caught on.
He doesn't have any ties nationally to, like, black leaders who would vouch for him, or any particular, like, high-profile Texas black community leaders. So I think he is, like, a little bit of a weird spot. I'm sorry.
For my third pick, it's between two outsider candidates. More or less outsider candidates. One actual outsider candidate. And one
a lot of prefacing.
I am going to go with, this is hard, Tulsi Gabbard.
Bad pick.
Wow.
The other option there, I think, was Andrew Yang. But I'm going to go with somebody who has more traditional political experience, because Democrats care about electability. And although I do not think they will elect Tulsi Gabbard as their nominee, she performed quite well in the debates last night. I think that she may have been the best public speaker on that debate stage. I don't think that her platform necessarily jives with the Democratic Party. It could interest the broader American public, but yeah, I don't think she'll win the nomination. I do think she could play an interesting role in an eventual Democratic administration.
She's
maybe
a problematic person, and she will not be in a Democratic administration.
Fair enough. Okay. I mean, the attack...
I think this is, like, a pretty clear... She is not going to be...
Well, maybe if Biden wins and she's, like, his wingman, basically.
I mean, she was doing so many favors for Biden last night. She was...
Yeah, it was interesting.
...attacking Kamala Harris as a woman of color on that stage when everyone else was piling on Biden. I mean...
That doesn't mean she has
Biden
a spot in future.
Biden should thank her.
That's an interesting question, but it doesn't mean that she is a person who any Democrat, I think, would appoint in a serious position.
The argument for picking Gabbard now, or some of the other kind of more offbeat candidates, is an argument Nate has made, which is like, in a world where one of the front runners or even one of the second tier candidates doesn't win, then you're talking about a world right. in which like something bonkers has happened. And then it's like, okay, all bets are off and maybe Gabbard is the nominee.
Okay, so I was making the kind of oddball economic argument for Elizabeth Warren. Here's the oddball kind of military argument for Tulsi Gabbard. We are in a really unpopular war by November 2020. Well, obviously, the Democrats will pick their nominee before November 2020, but whatever, in the next few months, that
January
sounds really dark, but, you know, and her kind of no never-ending wars platform takes off. Anyway.
There's a nuclear weapon dropped, and I'm not going
to... Sounds very
dark. That's too dark. Let's move
but
on.
But that's how she ended her, I mean...
But yeah, Mike is right that at this point we're getting into territory where something bonkers has happened. All right, Nate, you've got two picks. You've got to make them fast.
Yeah, so going on that kind of fractal uncertainty theory, then Yang, I think, is the next pick.
Boy, he's so pandering. The hat, Yang.
I mean, would you rather have Yang or rather have Gillibrand or something?
Yeah, I would. Okay. I'll take Gillibrand.
Okay, Yang, who's your other one, though?
Yang and Bullock.
Okay.
I mean, they at least have distinctive things about them.
Yeah.
Yang, maybe the theory of the case is that you turn out, I mean, I kind of, in a derogative way, refer to it as like all the different weirdos on the internet get together and vote for Yang. But he is someone who could turn out voters who are not traditional Democratic primary voters. And we saw with Bernie Sanders how that can actually lead to a fairly large coalition. We saw, obviously, it's not a winning case for Yang, but we saw with like, Ron Paul, he can turn out non-traditional voters, and all of a sudden you're in the mid-double digits or something, right? How did you get to 30%? I don't really know, but compared to the rest of the options, then who knows? And Bullock is legitimately like interesting because he is not purely like a Michael Bennett-style moderate. I think he has some things that would appeal to progressive voters, to populist voters. Whatever else, right? He's a little bit eccentric. He also is one of the few candidates with executive experience, and he has maybe one of the better electability cases to make.
All right. It's me again. I'm going to go a bit more traditional. I'm going to go with Gillibrand. Made a decent case for herself last night. She didn't command the stage, but she got in a few points that may help her make the third debate, which is more than you can say for a lot of the people on stage, because you have to be polling at 2%, you have to get 130,000 individual donors. So say she gets that, and all of a sudden when it's down to 10 on a single stage, she starts to shine through. Again, this is my fourth and final pick, so I go with Gillibrand. Claire?
Mike and I are comparing notes. There are no good people left to pick.
Hello, Marianne Williamson. Yeah. Where are the gays in the audience?
Claire passes on her pick.
I guess I'm going to go with star of stage and screen, John Delaney. America's most high-profile moderate of the last 24 hours. He's rich as hell. He is a member of Congress, and he probably will be the Kasich of the Democratic primary, i.e., he will stay in the race far longer than he should. And you gotta like that.
All right, Micah, wrap it up for us.
I'm continuing with the something really crazy happens. I'll pick... Can I pick, like, the field?
No, come on.
No, and he always does that, and then he picks Michelle Obama at the very end, and everyone goes crazy.
I pick Michelle Obama.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Good call. Okay,
this is what pandering looks like.
No. I actually, someone was writing about this real quick.
No.
If we get into a world where there's a brokered convention, which my editor-in-chief Nate Silver says is a real possibility, then we'll need a white horse candidate, and Michelle Obama comes riding in. She'd win. Michelle Obama.
All right. Now it is up
Claire
to
is looking at me
you
like...
all in the audience. We're going to ask for your applause as a signifier of who won. So first off, Micah, we don't applaud for panderers, but Micah.
Thank you.
Oh, wait, mate, listen to me. All right, next is Claire. Sorry, I should say for the audience at home what the actual lineups were. So Micah was Biden, Klobuchar, Inslee, and Michelle Obama. Claire was Harris, Castro, O'Rourke, and Delaney. I am Warren, Booker, Gabbard, and Gillibrand.
It's a Warren audience.
I call bullshit on this.
Whoever gets Warren is going to win the crowd vote.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I call bullshit on this.
And Nate is Sanders, Buttigieg, Yang, and Bullock.
That's an okay thing. Nate's is okay.
And that is a wrap for this installment of the 538 Democratic primary draft. Thank you all for your input. And with that, let's say goodbye. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you. Thank you, Micah. And thanks to all of you in the audience. And thank you so much to Detroit for hosting us in this beautiful city this week.
Yeah. I mean,
you all have a beautiful city on your hands. I really enjoyed my time here. My name is Galen Druk. A special thanks to Vanessa Diaz, again, our manager of business operations, who organized tonight's show. Thank you as well to Stephanie Roos and Tony Chow, the ABC News Live team, and everyone at Detroit's Majestic Theater. And again, thank you to Robert Yoon. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcast@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store, or just tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.